There are these genres of meditation retreats and also spiritual practices in the Tibetan tradition. This kind of a meditation retreat that we are engaging with would be called a semtet. Semtet means the path teachings on the mind or nature of mind, and these topics such as awareness, nirvana, consciousness. Often, these teachings given by the teachers can be quite actually spontaneous, personal, non-dogmatic. Teachers tend to use a lot of their own expression. From that point of view, I felt that this retreat is a semtet retreat, even though we didn't make any announcement about it. Last night, when I was observing the whole opening ceremony, it was quite inspiring. I was very inspired by to see all of you, and also James, Kate, Jill offered their speech and their ceremony. I remember, as you remember, that James read a paragraph from a book that I wrote a few years ago. I felt that somehow I totally forgot what I wrote. I felt like I was actually listening to somebody else's words rather than my words. But if my memory is correct, he said something like, in that reading, that we are consciousness. This is a quite interesting concept. Actually, it's not a concept. It's a quite an amazing epiphany that we can experience when we develop ourselves into the world of silence, contemplation. There are actually lots of topics and ideas like consciousness, awareness, that people usually don't relate to in the ordinary world unless they come to ground like here and observe silence and be part of a whole community, noble community, and also following these noble guidelines which are designed as a very much conducive means for the inner awakening. I almost brought this poem composed by very well-known Dzogchen master, Shabkarpa, who's my hero. And James also loves his work too. He wrote a very famous Doha, Song of Realization, known as The Flight of Garuda. Sometimes recite this one poem written by Shabkarpa as almost a guidance on the meditation retreat. Basically, in that poem, he said, we should be like sages of the India, sit in silence. That's why the silence, the practice of observing noble silence, has been very much important methods, technique means of purification, awakening in many traditions, because these ancient masters realized that unless we actually quiet ourselves, unless we observe silence, and somehow we are not able to remove some veils in our consciousness and to experience these notions, like consciousness, awareness. In the deep silence, like the way we are observing, sometimes magic happens, miracles happen. Not miracles that we often think about, like angels flying, double rainbows popping up in the sky, but magic or miracle happens, which is the opening eye of the Dharma, opening the eye of the truth. And this is a very old expression that Buddha himself talked about, the eye of Dharma. There's an eye of Dharma which has nothing to do with the third eye. Please remember that. And this is has to do with the eye of consciousness. Our eye, the consciousness has actually eye. Of course, metaphorically speaking, consciousness doesn't have a real physical eye, but in some sense you can say that our consciousness has eye, our heart has eye, our mind has eye. And when the consciousness opens its eyes, it can see things that we don't see usually through the ordinary mind, which is often veiled by many obscurations and hindrances. And then when the eye of heart opens, we are able to experience things that we can't experience because our heart is too small often. When the eye of heart opens, then we can experience unfathomable love, or love that can embrace everything, the totality. And therefore, I feel very comfortable to talk about consciousness during this meditation retreat, because we have been observing silence, even though we just had one, but I felt we have been sitting here for a long time energetically. And I really feel very comfortable to pretty much say anything that comes in my mind without any reservation. A friend of mine who's a part of my community, he's a kind of scientist a little bit, and he's also kind of mystic, according to him. He said when he hangs out with his buddies, his old friends who are scientists, he cannot actually even say the word mind, because it's too esoteric. The word mind is too spiritual, too esoteric. So he even can't talk about the word mind. Of course, the concept consciousness sound even more transcendent, more weird, more abstract, more non-material, more maybe even esoteric than the concept of mind. And here, because the power of the sacred container and our dedication, and also this noble silence, I believe that we can open our mind and our heart, and we're able to really see a whole new dimension of ourselves. We can connect to things that our ordinary, the thinking mind cannot comprehend usually. Topics like all-embracing love, divine desire, divine aspiration, divine yearning, awakening, egolessness, consciousness. But when last night Jim said that we are consciousness, usually that has a lot of meanings. Personally, when I hear somebody saying we are consciousness. I have quite an amazing response. By the way, everything that I have written in my book is actually not my words. I just interpreted all these beautiful teachings taught by the early Buddhist masters, and especially the great Dzogchen masters. I just put them into words. That's pretty much it. And therefore, I cannot actually take ownership over one word, one single concept in all those books that I have written. I'm more interpreter than actually teacher. That's how I identify. But usually when somebody says, we are consciousness, and maybe you will have this response, but my response is that and there's a kind of freedom in which that I can let go of my ordinary identities. And we all have ordinary identities. We play different roles. We have our persona. We identify ourselves as this and that, a man, a woman, spiritual, ordinary teacher, and spouse, etc. And then when you can't feel that, you are consciousness, and suddenly all this ordinary or more ego identities fall apart on their own. And then you begin to actually feel that you are this indescribable reality. In a way that you can feel then you are the spirit who is simply being incarnated in a human form. Or you may be able to actually connect to this beautiful myth and the stories told by the ancient ones. And there is actually a belief in some tradition that the angels had to play music and to actually invite and trick the souls to enter through our ears and to be incarnated in this form. So you may be able to feel sometimes and that you are actually a soul who entered into this form because a whole host of angels played music and you are deceived. And you're tricked to be in this body, in this incarnation, this human form. Or you may be able to feel that you are this indescribable. So anyway, one important practice of all the spiritual traditions, either Buddhism or Sufism or Advaita Vedanta or Kashmiri Shaivism or the Christian mysticism, they all actually use in many ways similar methodology in a way that we can let go of our ordinary identities. Like in the Tibetan tradition, we have sadness in which that we visualize ourselves as a deity, a divine being. We visualize ourselves as a Tara. There are lots of Tara images around here. I even saw image of a white Tara, tongue of white Tara at the interview room. And there are also many other Taras and different deities. And there was in the Tibetan tradition, the practitioners, meditators, visualize themselves as these deities, like devas, dakas, and dakinis, herukas. And then sometimes we even have actually sacred dance in which we dress ourselves as these divine beings, even though they're not outside, they're just a symbol or expression of our true nature, and then we dance, we chant, and we visualize ourselves as the deity, and we sing the names of those deities, and we dress up ourselves as deities, so we have at least a moment in which that we feel that we totally let go of all our earthly, our egoic identities, in which that we become the indescribable, we become the consciousness, we become the awareness, we become the soul, or we become the spirit. And that's why it was very nice to hear when James opened this meditation retreat by saying that we are the consciousness. I thought, oh, this is already a powerful retreat. Maybe a little bit too powerful for me. Can we talk something much simpler than that? When he said that, oh, James had really some plan, and I felt that he has been planning this for a long time. You know, James does everything with the great caring, not like me. I tend to think sometimes a little bit of clumsy strategy. And I really appreciate that James had a vision about this meditation retreat. As a person, I feel that he is somebody who has lots of heart. I'm actually talking about James not because he's my friend, but I feel that I must talk about him because I feel that in many ways this whole meditation retreat is his creation. And I feel I'm just participating in his wonderful creation that he has been planning for a long time. And also it's very fun to teach with somebody who loves you. Right? I feel lots of love from James. But one thing I want you to get from James is this burning desire. He has this burning desire. And you can kind of tell sometimes comes through his presence, through his teachings. He has this burning desire to wake up. And that's why I felt yesterday he fully just poured in front of us this burning desire, and he really wanted all of us to wake up, whatever that means. And it's very important for us to have that kind of burning desire. And hopefully we can learn how to have it, because it's not an intellectual thing. It's not something you can learn or you can memorize. It's not something that you can use your mental prowess or your intelligence to learn it. You can learn it, this kind of burning desire. You have to feel it. Sometimes it takes a long time to learn how to have it. But I must say that the secret of spiritual awakening, if this is something we want, it's actually there's a burning desire. It is almost said in my tradition that no one can wake up without having that burning desire, which we call it devotion. Just a few weeks ago, I was leading a meditation retreat in Asia, as you have heard. First, I led a 2 days meditation retreat at this very beautiful Buddhist retreat center, city retreat center, with elevators, believe it or not, belongs to the Chuge order, the largest Korean Buddhist society. And then I taught, and I was having a little bit of jet lag, and felt that I couldn't really completely be there 100%. But also I noticed that some people were playing their smartphone, and people were listening to my teaching while they're also looking at their smartphone. And I was okay too. It didn't really insult me anyway. And then the best part was the food. We had all this fermented food, kimchi, all kind of kimchi. You know, they say there are 400 kimchis in South Korea. That was shocking. I know that I think France had 400 cheese in 1940s, and now they have around 700 cheese. They just keep adding more and more all this exotic cheese. So, and I thought, oh, that was all right. I was having a jet lag, and people were looking at the smartphone, so it's okay. The best part was the food. And then they said, now we are going to take you to this most beautiful part of the Korea, close to the border, border with North Korea. This is the most beautiful place in entire South Korea, and there is a retreat center. That's where we are going to have a retreat. And then we drove for a few hours, and we got very close to the border. It turned out to be, I don't know, but not too far away from the border, which is considered the most volatile place on the earth, and where dangerous wars can actually start. It's very kind of intensive, in a weird way. When I went to Bodhaga, I felt very much intense. I felt that all my blood is circulating. In the same way, when I went to that place, I had a similar experience in a strange way. Didn't feel like love or devotion, but felt I'm actually arriving at not particularly holy sites, but powerful sites where things can happen if you are not conscientious. Anyway, then the retreat center was named after a Korean monk whose name was Munghe, and who wrote lots of poems. He lived perhaps in the 20th century, but he was a bhikshu, he was a fully ordained monk, but he wrote all these love poems. And some people started doubting whether he is really a real monk or not, because he wrote all these love poems, but turned out that he was writing all these love poems to express his love to his country, as well as his love to the awakening, to the enlightenment. He was he had so much love, so much burning desire to wake up that he had to write down. In the Tibetan tradition, one poet reminded me of him is the sixth Dalai Lama, who wrote also lots of love poems, and he expressed his longing to wake up through those poems. So anyway, James, I feel, has this kind of burning desire to wake up. Maybe that's why he opened this retreat, by inviting all of us to really experience this liberating truth that we are consciousness. So either we say we are consciousness, or we are spirit, or we are the unborn Buddha, or we are pure awareness, or we call ourselves as the primordial Buddha. The whole point is, and there's a way that we can lose sometimes our ego identities. And when we lose our ego identities, we feel that we have been actually locked up in this invisible chains for a long time, and not knowing that we have been tormented, we went through lots of pain, simply because we are locked up in those chains, those invisible chains, our egoic identities. And then when you have the moment of a realization that you are consciousness, you are spirit, and then you realize that you are none of these identities. From that point of view, we are consciousness, but also we are consciousness because we are here, and we are alive, we are breathing, we are sensing, we are feeling. The word consciousness in Tibetan is namshi. And nam means, this is a little bit of a tricky translation, it can get into unnecessary philosophical conundrum. Namshi means mental image, shi means to know. Please forget the first part of this terminology. It's a little bit of too philosophical, but she means to be aware, to know, but also means to feel, to recognize, to sense, And this is really who we are. If you look right now at yourself, you are conscious, you are feeling, you are sensing, you are thinking. Regardless of what state of mind you are going through, either you are feeling peacefulness, stillness, open heart, loving kindness, or maybe you are feeling confused, lost, and bored. Or maybe you are somebody seeing the colors of flower in front of you. Or maybe you are just enjoying this space. Or maybe you are hearing somebody talking without so much effort. You just hear what is happening. And this is showing that indeed you are alive, you are a consciousness. And the experience of a consciousness is actually totally myriad and various. We can really go up and we can really go down, just like riding roller coaster. Sometimes to explore your mind, your consciousness is like riding roller coaster. It can go really up all the way and then can go down, or you can stay in the middle for a very long time. That's what most people do. Perhaps I told you this funny story that one time I was in Asia during the Q&A, somebody wrote down and said that he or she is having this very profound epiphany in which that he or she feels that she's one with everybody and she's having a hard time to engage with the world of duality, the practical world, because he or she feels that she's one with everybody all the time. And then this person is kind of looking for my affirmation, whether that is enlightenment or not. And then I told that person, don't worry, this is a problem, but it's a nice problem. Most people don't have this problem. But this problem is very easy to be solved. All you need is to go to US Embassy, get visa, and go to United States and drive a car like 15 miles per hour like an old granny and so on. People are going to yell at you and they're going to do lots of weird things, and then you lose that experience right there. So don't worry. So you see now the experience of consciousness is a very sometimes beautiful, but very deceptive. You can't really take your experiences too personally or too concrete. And that's why I think all Buddhist traditions say don't get touched to experience. Let me talk a little bit about the Abhidharma, which is very much one of the main treaties that we all study, either Theravadan Buddhist or Tibetan Buddhist or Mahayana Buddhist. And Abhidharma, you have this is a really kind of fantastic map of the universe. By the way, as a tradition, Buddhism has been using lots of images, also illustrations, even like maps, even cosmology to explain the workings of human consciousness, yours and mine consciousness. And we're not going to talk about mandala, that's all another topic. Mandala is more like Tantric Buddhist presentation of the human consciousness. But in the Abhidharma, there is a mountain Meru, the queen of the mountains, which really symbolize our consciousness. And then on the mountain Meru, around it, the whole loka, the whole universe comes into being. But these existences, lokas, realms, actually represent different mental states. And basically, they divided the whole universe into three realms called the realm of desire, the realm of form, and the realm of formlessness. But These are, of course, in some sense, physical dimensions, but on the other hand, they are like maps, like they are geography of the human consciousness. And so we say often in our tradition that don't get touched to your experiences. If you get touched to your experience, then you can fall into one of those three realms, which we don't want to be, because three realms, the realm of desire, realm of form, realm of formlessness, are the samsara, which is, of course, a state of your own mind. For example, they say, if you get attached during the meditation to the bliss, then you fall into the realm of desire, which is samsara, the unawakened state of mind. And then, whereas if you get very attached to the clarity, and then you can fall into the realm of the world of form. But then if you get attached to no thoughts, like no thoughts, no mind, and then you can get trapped and you can fall into another samsara, which is an unawakened state of your mind. Especially, it is represented by the highest realm within the samsara, the realm of formlessness. I hope this is not getting too complicated, but anyway, the whole point is not to get attached to any experiences, the ordinary to the extraordinary, while we are in this meditation retreat. So let me go back to the topic, the consciousness. Well, I think we are pretty much sure that we are consciousness, right? Unless somebody has strong objection. Let's say we are consciousness. And, well, there are lots of debate why we even manifest as a consciousness. Isn't it quite interesting? Have you ever thought about that? Why even you are here? Why you even exist in the first place as a consciousness? Well, some artists say, I heard from, I think, a radio. Sometimes they have lots of wisdoms, the radios. Some said maybe we manifested as a consciousness because the universe creates itself in this like a mind-blowing design, architecture, cosmic architecture. Universe is truly amazing. And there's so many countless wonders and magics that we can observe. And that's why somebody has to sit there and be observer and be totally dumbfounded by this extraordinary creation, the universe's self-creation. Otherwise, it would be futile creation if nobody says, oh, this is really amazing creation. So some people believe that universe manifested as human beings, especially through our consciousness, so she can pretend there's a universe and pretend there's an observer, and then we can pretend to be very dumbfounded. Oh, this is quite amazing. See, the beautiful rainbow, the northern light. I was visiting Sierra Mountains just a few days ago. I went to Lake Tahoe and hiked and saw this beautiful lake. I really felt this is just amazing creation, this universe, this totality is so amazing to the extent I felt totally humbled. I felt a little bit even death of my ego here and there. And something you don't feel in some parts of the world, I won't mention those particular places, but I think California has all these places that can totally blow your mind. We are very blessed to be in this part of the world. But also, I think it's true that we are consciousness, we have this awareness, so we can witness the ugly part of the world. The universe is not always beautiful. It can be beautiful, but there's also ugliness, there's violence, there's suffering, and there's delusion. And I think we are here to open our heart and to experience all of them. Let me share quite a personal story about my own journey as a meditator, as a human being. Some of you have heard that I had a little bit of medical adventure. Now I'm very much recovered from it. And at one point I was having difficulty to walk. I had problem developed in left side of my body. And then around the same time, I was traveling quite a lot, even though I had this physical pain. One of the places that I went to was the city of Santa Barbara. I was having a lot of pain already at that time. And then I went to beach. And it was very interesting for me to go there and to walk on the beach. You know that the beaches in Santa Barbara are truly lovely. And also the city is very beautiful there too. I gave a day-long meditation retreat, also evening public talk, and then I walked on the beach because many years ago I also gave a talk somewhere in Santa Barbara. I had a chance to walk on the beach and I never forgot how beautiful the beaches there were. And I asked people, take me to the beach. And then I was walking on the beach, I was totally basically enchanted by the beach. I loved the smell of Pacific Ocean for some reason. I loved the smell of the ocean along the west coast for some reason. And some people don't like it, but I love it very much. And also high cliffs. So I found personally the beaches in the west coast in California most beautiful in the world after visiting many beaches. The high cliffs, the smell, and then we have lots of birds, seagulls, cranes. And I was very much enchanted by the wonder of the ocean, the nature, but same time I was having also pain too. In the moment that I was witnessing both pain, joy, little bit of suffering, and also happiness. And it was kind of personally very meaningful experience because I had to, without choice, open my heart and to really experience all flavors of this life, this existence. And that's why we are consciousness and we can open heart and we can feel love and compassion. We can wake up, we can also descend, we can get really lost and be a little bit sometimes if I can say crazy, can I say that? So the consciousness can go in many directions. So the way we can wake up as a consciousness is through awareness, which was the topic I've been preparing. Famous Dzogchen master Rinzen Goddenjin said, one ground, two paths. Because that, there are two fruitions. The commentary on that verse is that one ground can be anything. One ground can be so-called emptiness or the consciousness or the primordial mind or anything you want to say. Because it's not conceptual. The one ground, the source of all. Then the two paths is actually the awareness and unawareness. Out of those two paths, now there are two fruitions, which are liberation and imprisonment, or the samsara, or nirvana, or the suffering and the happiness. And that's why awareness is so important. Awareness is maybe the only means that can liberate us, that can wake us up, that we can continue to heal ourselves. So what is awareness? It's a very big topic. It's not one thing. Awareness has many aspects. Awareness is sometimes mindfulness, sometimes self-knowledge, sometimes contemplation, sometimes experiences that maybe we don't go through unless you are doing specific practices. So awareness means a lot. It all depends on the context. But here tonight, I'm going to describe awareness as basically samadhi or sati in Pali, samadhi in Sanskrit, the mindfulness or remembrance. The mindfulness is actually very much the essential practice for all Buddhist traditions. I know that some people think that not too many Theravadan Buddhists think, but some Tibetan Buddhists think that mindfulness is a Theravadan Buddhist thing. But that's not true. They don't know what they're missing. This Tibetan Buddhist, the mindfulness is actually the heart of all the Buddhist traditions. In the Dzogchen, we talk about six levels of mindfulness. Dhamma, Tuktamba means Tibetan word for sati or samadhi or mindfulness. So let's talk about mindfulness. Itself is a very big topic in many ways, but it also can be simple. To me, the awareness begins by turning our attention inward. This is how we start awareness, how we start mindfulness, and then from there it can grow, it can expand, it can evolve. But I feel that this is how we began the path of awareness or the mindfulness, simply by turning our attention inward. Lama Mipham, another Nyingmaba master, said, One inward dharma is better than 100 outward dharmas. This is a very interesting statement, which is my favorite. Let me say that. One inward dharma is better than 100 outward dharmas. And he's a well-respected Dzogchen master in my lineage, the Nyingmaba tradition. So what he meant is like any kind of dharma or spiritual activities that we do, that is lacking in introspection is the outward dharma. If you do these outward dharmas, yes, they have a merit, they have a benefit. We cannot deny the benefit or merit of these outward dharma activities. But when he said inward dharma means dharma, the spiritual practice that has a quality of introspection, which is to really look inside, looking into our mind. And this sounds very simple, but it turned out to be actually the most difficult thing to do. Shockingly, this is not something that most people want to do, even though it sounds so simple. And people want to do other things, but not this one. People can do a lot of things. People are very courageous. People can do all kinds of things, as you know. But one thing that people are not good at is just sit and look into that mind. That has turned out to be the most difficult task to perform, harder than climbing Mount Everest, believe it or not, or jumping off a cliff. But this is really what people don't want to do. And there are many reasons why people don't want to do. First, we can say there's a resistance to the awakening. Obviously, right? There's a resistance to the awakening. If there's no resistance to the awakening, we'll be all running towards awakening. That's all we want to do. And then maybe we need the retreat for unawakening. Because everybody won't wake up because there's no resistance. Then maybe we should have some kind of really big meditation retreat on the unawareness, because all world wants to wake up, so we need some few unawakened people to keep this world a little bit interesting. And then my job would be different. I won't be Dharma teacher. I will be ego teacher or something like that. Travel all over, teach people how to have ego, how to be greed, how to be selfish. And we make sure that there's really good food, otherwise people don't come to the field. Close eye, feel your ego, feel anger, let's judge somebody. So obviously there's a resistance to the awakening. I have no idea why this is part of our system, but we do have a very much a evolutionary level, deep-seated resistance to the awakening. We don't want to wake up. We don't want to be free. And so that's, of course, one reason that people don't want to look inside. Recently, a psychologist said that that I always quote this one. It's very interesting as well as a truthful statement that we human beings are afraid of three things. Guess these three things. Of course, death. Death is one of them because most people are afraid of death. That's why we don't even talk about death. And then another thing is actually people. We are afraid of people. We are afraid of other people. And we even don't know that. That's why there's so much mistrust. And that's why we objectify people. And we don't know how to trust people. We don't know how to love each other. We are always in the mode of offending and defending. We are constantly, unconsciously objectifying people. And we really don't know how to love and condition each other. And then last one turned out to be mind. We are very afraid of our own mind. Because, you know, once we look into our mind, we don't know what to do with all these things. We don't know with our anxiety. We don't know what to do with our fear. We don't know what to do with our judgment. We don't know what to do with our guilt and shame. We don't know what to do with this wild monkey. This sometimes quite a wild, unruly, dangerous creature. I gave one time talk at a school in Missoula, Montana. Invited everybody to just observe a silence for 5 minutes before my talk. And that wasn't very long. And then after my talk, we had a long greeting line to where people can come and exchange words with me. And then there was this person, she looks really peaceful, but she said, "Do you know that 5 minutes of silence was the worst time in my life?" And I never forget that statement. I think she's speaking the truth. It's very hard sometimes to just observe silence, and especially if you're a beginner, if you never meditated, you really don't know what to do with this fear, pain, and the boredom. And then, if you continue to look inside, then you're going to feel that you're not just looking at your anxiety, your random thought. You feel you're on this kind of journey that you have never signed in the first place, but somehow you end up embark on this really powerful journey, and where you begin to explore all these uncharted territories, and where you're going to meet with many monsters too, these formless monsters and dangerous creatures, the monsters of maybe greed and hatred, etc. You begin to learn so much about yourself. It can be very humiliating sometimes, or humbling. And then also you're going to discover and that you have so much potential. You can love, you can forgive, you can let go. And you begin to learn that you can be actually happy, you can be happy unconditionally. I think this is perhaps the best logic we can see, best evidence we can see in this life is that I can be happy. I can be truly happy if I want. I can be truly happy simply by going inward and learning how to cultivate awareness and to purify my vasanas, my old mental, psychological, mental tendencies, so I can be truly happy. And then I can realize I have so much potential. And then not only that, I can look around and see we all have so much potential. At one of the meditation retreat in Asia recently, we had a nice ending party where we played music and we invite people to do performance. First, many people were a little bit reluctant to get up and dance, sing a song, and offer performance, but we had around 8 or 9 bhikshus, and they are from Zen tradition, and one monk got up and he just danced without any inhibition, and he was wearing this gray robe, and he was just beautifully dancing, and his robes are moving in the air. It was very beautiful. And then his dance gave permission everybody to get up and dance. This was the end of the meditation retreat. We were observing silence for many days, I think 6 days, and we did the same thing, somebody collect everybody's smartphone. But towards the end of the meditation retreat, we decided to have a little party, like sacred feast. And then everybody's happy. Everybody want to get up to dance, so we had to stop doing that because otherwise we could go whole night. Eventually everybody was raising their hands. And they all want to offer something, either dance or party or song. So we couldn't let everybody to dance. But there was so much joy and happiness. And then one person said something like that. Isn't it amazing that we human beings have so much potential? We have potential not to fight with each other, not to hate each other, and not to be selfish, and not to be lost in our inner demons. We have so much potential to be happy, potential to love, potential to forgive, potential to transcend limitations that our ancestors couldn't. We have potential to come together as a humanity, as one family, and to put all this side difference, all our miseries, and all our bad stories behind, and to open heart, and to love each other, and to work for the benefit of the great. And that's why we are here. Much gratitude. Right, 8:30? Yeah, 8:30. Thank you. So I didn't get anywhere with awareness, but thank you. Another time, Jim said I can talk more. Let me continue. Stay tuned.